Welcome, podcast listeners.
Hey-ho.
And before we get to talking about this week's show, I'm going to get a little duty out of the way.
What's that, sir?
Well, we need to thank all of our supporters for the Thomas Jefferson Hour, as I always say. We are a listener-supported show and podcast. We receive no corporate support. We receive no public radio support. So without the support of listeners like you, podcast listeners, we would not be able to continue this program. And I think I can say safely that you and I both desperately want to continue this program.
In fact, I think I just climbed Mount Whitney in California, 14,500.
I think listeners
said they would give
a
dollar.
Toe.
No, they would give a dollar for every foot that I ascended.
Now, why didn't you think of that before
they
you went?
They sponsored me up the mountain.
Anyway, it's that time of year when people think about charitable contributions.
You should be nicer about my foot. So, you know, you don't. You're not limping.
Hey, I'm trying to do a pitch here. Huh?
I'm just saying, be nice about my toe.
All right. It is the time of the year when people think about charitable contributions, and if you would like to make a contribution to ensure that the Thomas Jefferson Hour makes it through 2018, go to jeffersonhour.com, click on the donate button, and you will find out how you can make a tax-deductible donation to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and you might even be able to get one of the audiobooks of Becoming Jefferson's People.
I think we still have a few of them.
We do. We're about out of hard copy books, I'm afraid.
We're going to have to reprint.
Yeah,
there's another gift you can make to the Jefferson
Hour. Might have to do a fund. You know, we should do a GoFundMe or something for that.
Yeah.
Anyway, on to the show. It was a great, fun conversation this week.
I'll tell you, this is an important one. You say great and fun, but I have been thinking about what is a legitimate protest? When do people have a right to protest? And what shape should that protest take? And an even more interesting question in some ways is, how do you keep the protest movement focused on the actual thing it's protesting and not let it be morphed into something else?
So this week's conversation is about that with President Jefferson.
And I think you will find that Jefferson is, of all the figures in American history, is the last person you should turn to if you want someone to condemn protest.
We'd have to extend that conversation quite a bit, and I would like to do that. But Jefferson was a master at using phraseology to get his point across. Is that?
And he also was a master of using organic metaphors, because an organic metaphor sounds so wholesome. But really, what he's talking about in some cases is armed rebellion.
Having said that, we'll get to this week's show, which is, a pretty interesting conversation.
And we want people's response. This is one.
Absolutely.
They should, if they want to read a book about this, they should read Connor Cruz O'Brien, The Long Affair, mm-hmm. Thomas Jefferson and the French Revolution, which has, it's almost an anthology of every radical, rebellious, incendiary thing that Jefferson ever said or wrote. And so they can...
That whole thing really marked him for life, didn't it?
It did. I mean, he saw two revolutions, David.
Fairly and unfairly.
A benign one here and a violent one there. And Jefferson looked at it and said...
When you say a benign one here, what do you mean?
Well, you know, there was not a lot of social upheaval in the American Revolution. There was not a civil war, let's put it that way.
Okay.
But in the French Revolution, I mean, mobs were tearing people apart in streets. One of Jefferson's friends was literally pulled out of a carriage and torn apart, limb from limb, by a mob. I mean, we're talking about when you release the mob, things can happen.
What we're talking about this week, though, is peaceful protests.
Well, Jefferson would go farther, but yes. But if you show Jefferson's defense of protest per se, including bloody protest, then peaceful protest seems like a pretty harmless and benign thing by contrast.
Protest is one of the highest forms of patriotism in America, don't you think?
Well, you'll see in the essay this week, I kind of give a short history of protest in America, and you realize it's some of the greatest hits. The Boston Tea Party, you know, when the Tea Party were out in 2010, they were carrying unloaded guns into the public square. They were waving incendiary signs with unspeakable insults to the administration they disliked. And they were speaking of Second Amendment solutions to America's problems. That's incendiary nonviolent protest.
I suspect we're going to get some mail on this, and I hope we do.
We're eager to hear people's point of view.
Absolutely.
Let's listen to this.
Civil discourse. Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me, I'm pleased to say, is President Thomas Jefferson. So good to see you this week, sir.
Good day to you, my dear citizen.
Mr. Jefferson, I wanted to talk to you this week, to get right to it, if I might, about liberty, about freedom in the United States, and about citizens' rights to dissent.
Dissent is essential to living in a Republican society. Anybody who thinks that you can go through your existence in harmony with government, or even in harmony with your fellow citizens on all occasions, is living in a mythical world. You know, government is particularly, however idealistic or honest or thoughtful it is at its inception, will inevitably become wasteful and insensitive and to a certain degree despotic and self-righteous. This is a rule of life that appears to have no antidotes. And so the only thing we can do is to watch for it. And when our governments cease to be responsive to our rights and our needs and the will of the people, then we have to pull it back into line. And that can only be done by expressing in the public square how we feel the system has diverged from its founding principles. And government almost never reforms itself. Government has to be reformed by vigilant people. And the method ideally would be pure remonstration. You write a letter to the government and they see the error of their ways and they self-reform. But that almost never happens. You almost always need to raise the level of rhetorical objection high enough to get the attention of government, and you need to be willing to follow through and to punish those who misuse the public trust, at least by retiring them to the private sphere, or you cannot remain free in the long run.
Mr. President, you, during my time, are known as somewhat of a rebellious man. You approved of rebellions, and I go back to a couple of letters that you wrote in 1787. Now, I should point out that it's my understanding both of these letters were written in response to Shays' Rebellion. Could you perhaps tell our listeners what that was about?
Yes. So after the revolution was successful, we now settled into our life as a new republic. And we all assumed at the time that things would go very well, and that there would be an unprecedented period of harmony and community and prosperity. But it turns out that the economic dislocations that came after the war, we had, after all, spent an enormous amount of money to pry away from Great Britain. And once we were independent, Britain punished us by using economic coercions and discriminations that prevented us from prospering as we had as parts of the British Empire. So while we were colonies of Britain, there was economic possibility for us that the British mulishly and I think punitively closed off after the peace treaty in 1783 to punish us. They didn't want us to succeed. They didn't want us to be full equal economic partners. They wanted to re-enslave us economically, even though they had lost the capacity to enslave us politically. And so we were suffering a little. And the farmers of Massachusetts in particular, and I speak mostly of Western Massachusetts, were caught up in this crisis of economics, and they found that they were being foreclosed upon. They had farms and they owed banks and others monies. Because of the inflation and the deflation and the chaos of the post-war period, they were unable to pay. And so they went to the state legislature in Springfield and said, you know, we're honest citizens. Many of us are war veterans. We fought for this country. We're not lazy. We're growing food. The only thing that's wrong is that the economics of the moment do not make us cash flow, do not make us have the capacity to pay our bills on time. And so we ask the the state legislature to step in and give us some relief, to give us more time, somehow to help create conditions of economic stability, maybe to prevent some foreclosures. But we're asking for relief. And when they went to the banks and to the state legislature, they were turned away and treated as bums, treated as irresponsible citizens who were unwilling to pay their fair share of taxation and to honestly pay their bills. And so when they realized that the very representatives they had sent to Springfield to represent their interests turned their backs on them and rebuked them and sent them home in ignominy, then these farmer citizens rose up in rebellion under the leadership of a man named Daniel Shays, who had been in the American Armed Services during the war, and they reluctantly marched on some foreclosures and some banks and some judicial offices and prevented the dislocation from the land of honest farmer citizens who were suffering through no actual fault of themselves. This is known as Shays' Rebellion, 1786. It had many effects, but here are two of them. It inspired disgust rather than sympathy in the minds of a number of key patriots, including John and Abigail Adams and George Washington and others. In other words, instead of thinking that the farmers had a point of view and that we ought to have tried harder to accommodate them, the great national leaders of the country tended to condemn this rebellion, and Abigail Adams, for example, found it shocking and horrifying and never thought that the working classes would presume to rise up against their betters and so on and so forth. So that was the first effect, is that it actually helped to create a conservative reaction to what were regarded as some of the ideals and excesses of the American Revolution. And the second effect is that it helped to precipitate the Constitutional Convention. So there had been attempts over a couple of years to create some sort of an authority to amend the Articles of Confederation. But now, because of Shays' Rebellion, a sense of urgency came, and a lot of the 55 men who met in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 met there in reaction, an almost horrified reaction to the convulsions, as they were called, on the Massachusetts frontier.
I refer specifically to a letter that you wrote to Mr. Madison.
To James Madison, my closest friend.
On January 30th of 1787. And it's a famous letter. It includes a couple of quotes that are oft used today, including, "I hold it that a little rebellion now and then is a good thing, and as necessary in the political world as storms in the physical." You go on to say, "It is a medicine necessary for the sound health of government."
Well, let me start by saying that here was this rebellion, and this is an armed rebellion where farmer citizens have taken up their muskets and ridden their horses into the public square and interrupted court proceedings and interrupted foreclosures of farms. And they intimidated some judges and they intimidated some bankers. There was not any violence to speak of, perhaps a little tarring and feathering here and there, but this was not the French Revolution, let's put it that way. And so my point was in reaction. I was in Paris at the time. I was not in the United States. I was so a long, long way from Western Massachusetts. And when I heard about all of this, I thought, well, what is the right reaction to this? And I think this is the case that everyone should take up in the event of a protest movement. So I do understand that there is a protest. I'm trying to understand what their principles are, what they're protesting. And now I need to ask myself, what is the responsible remedy of the state of Massachusetts or the United States of America, or what's the responsible reaction of an American citizen to this protest movement? And instead of condemning it, as did 95% of all leaders in this country, I thought, no, wait a minute. This is a good sign, because it means that the people have not gone to sleep. It means that they have a lively sense of their rights when they think that the system is unfairly working against them and that their representatives are not representing their needs are not attempting to redress these grievances, but instead sending them home in shame, people have a right to object to that so strongly that if they need to shut down some foreclosure proceedings, that's not a sign of something bad in our body politic. That's actually a sign of the health of our system, that the people still have a lively sense of their rights and are not afraid to enforce them when they're being trampled upon.
Later in that year, November of that year, you wrote to Colonel William Smith, and from that letter comes another quote that people that people often refer to during my time, sir, and that is, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants." Now, is that a bit of hyperbole, or did you mean that literally?
I suppose it's both, sir. I was a very peaceful man. I never struck anyone in the whole course of my life. I certainly never shot a musket at somebody. I didn't participate in any war. I was never in a street action. And so harmony and peacefulness are my habits. But I do believe that if I like these organic metaphors, the tree of liberty, if you want the tree of liberty to flourish, it is going to have to be watered from time to time with blood. And if you think that the tree of liberty can survive and flourish without the threat of blood and sometimes the shedding of blood, then I think you have not studied Greek history, Persian history, Egyptian history, Roman history, the history of the Middle Ages, the history of early modern Europe, the history of Great Britain, or the history of any society in the whole course of human events. The fact is that you cannot maintain liberty except with the threat of using violence to do so. I hope that we can build into our system mechanisms that don't require it, but I never will rule it out.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. I have many more questions, and I'd like to get to those in a moment. Right now, we need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson, who is seated across from me now. Welcome back, Mr. President.
Thank you, citizen.
We were talking in our previous part of the conversation about a couple of your famous quotes. "I hold it that a little rebellion now and then is a good thing, and the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the bloods of patriots and tyrants." Mr. President, knowing you, having had these conversations with you over the years, I've always had a respect for you that has just grown, sir. And that your ability to have such a long view of America and where it came from and where it's going. And when I read these quotes and I think about you, your desire for harmony, your love for the country, your respect for the Constitution and law, I almost wonder, sir, was there a part of you that thought, this is a test for our government, and we shall see it through, and it's proof that our government can survive and work? Or did you fear for the future of the nation because of these outbursts?
I fear despotism with its orderliness and control and rigidity and restraint more than I fear the yeasty and somewhat anarchic stuff of liberty. In other words, given the choice of too much government or anarchy, by which I mean no government at all, I would not hesitate to prefer anarchy. Fortunately, we don't have to choose in so stark a fashion. But given the choice between too much government, and by the way, that is almost every government that has ever existed on Earth, or too little government, say, as amongst the Indians of the American West, I would not hesitate to prefer anarchy. So that's number one. Number two, people don't protest for the fun of it. People protest when conditions are such that they can no longer remain quiet. They would rather just go about their lives. People don't particularly like social tension. People don't want to jeopardize their economic interests or their civil rights. And so when people finally have had enough, as I put it in the Declaration of Independence, when a long train of abuses and usurpations shows them that there is a systematic attempt to hold them down or to oppress them, then people reluctantly, and it is always reluctantly in my view, stand up, rise up, and demand a due respect for their rights. But this isn't something that people do recreationally. Oh, there may be a few in the course of history. Mob actions always attract certain people that just are drawn to them like moths to a fire. But for the most part, protest comes because conditions have become intolerable. And so when that happens, a healthy society needs to say, I wonder what this is about. You know, maybe we should attend to this. If they feel that strongly about it, that they're willing to take their muskets and pitchforks into the street, this must be important, and maybe there's a way in which we have been ignoring their concerns, and we could redress them by honest negotiation and mild reforms to the existing system. That's the proper response. Now, when I said all of these things about the Tree of Liberty and so on, I like a little rebellion now and then. It's as important in the political arena as a thunderstorm is in the natural world. You know, people were shocked. People like Abigail Adams and John Adams and George Washington and the respectable classes, the establishment, were shocked by this sort of language. They couldn't believe that a person of my social standing and my rank in the American pantheon of important and powerful people would speak in so favorable way about armed rebellion and the shedding of blood. I do realize this, that people had a hard time making sense of this in my time and also in your time. But the fact is, I've done my reading, perhaps more than any other American on this subject, and I know that if you read the history of the Roman Republic, and particularly the history of the Roman Empire, you inevitably realize that governments and societies do not self-correct. They must be made to reform by the insistence of the sovereign. And let me remind you that the people are the sovereign, not government. Government exists to serve the people. The people don't exist to serve the government. And when the government goes wrong, as it did in 1776, the people have a sacred natural right to rise up and overthrow that government and to institute a new one that is more in keeping with their rights, their needs, and their aspirations. That's the basis of the Declaration of Independence, the most famous and important document in American history. And I wasn't saying it for rhetorical purposes. I said it because I meant it. We were justifying our armed rebellion against Great Britain. And essentially, the Declaration of Independence said we were patient as long as we could be patient. Our patience has finally run out. We know that as British citizens and as humans, we have rights that the British Crown and the British Parliament and the ministry are not respecting. And since we have petitioned them until we are so weary of writing petitions that we can no longer even stomach another one, we are now finally forced by them, rebelling and forming a new nation that will be more responsive to the sovereign, to the will of the people. So people were always shocked by this, as if I were doing this for some sort of a sensationalist effect or for rhetorical effect. That isn't so at all. I said these things because I meant them, and I believe that at the heart of any free society is the right to protest.
Mr. President, I've lived through many different forms of protest during my lifetime, and I think if you knew the details of all of these different protests, you would say, well, that's good, that's healthy, that's the American public doing what they should do. And we're living through another period like that right now. I want to be careful. There are passionate feelings on both sides of the issue that I'm going to refer to, sir.
Well, if you believe that protest is usually an irresponsible thing, and that people should just learn to live with whatever is wrong in their society, then you've asked the wrong founding father for his comments. You know, Hamilton would talk that way, I think. Even James Madison, my closest friend, would talk that way in many moods. Of all of the founding fathers, if you have Rufus King and Fisher Ames and Timothy Pickering on the far right, and Hamilton near the right end of the spectrum, and John Adams somewhere in the middle, and George Washington to the right of him, and then on my end of it, Madison and Monroe and Thomas Paine and a few others. Of all of that spectrum of the founding fathers, the one who is most likely to defend protest, most likely to believe that blood is an important, possibly essential tool in the maintenance of human liberty, that's me. So if you were speaking to Alexander Hamilton, I'm sure he would say, people protest because they're bored, and people protest because they're antisocial, and people should mind their own business and realize that better men are in charge of the world, and the less people attend to their civil liberties, the more likely we are to have an orderly and prosperous society. I am not that person, sir.
Well, let me explain in general terms what's going on. There is a group of people in the United States who feel that they have been treated unfairly, to say it mildly, that they've been treated with disrespect and violence, which I won't go into, sir, but and very cleverly, those who oppose them have turned their argument into these people are being unpatriotic and they're not respecting the country. It's a clever argument, and it's working.
The forces of establishment, the forces of oppression, let's say, always use the same argument. Not now. This is the wrong forum. We can attend to this in some more rational way, that the abuses are being exaggerated, that these are hotheads who really just love protest for the sake of protest, that if you had the information that we have, you wouldn't find fault with the established way of things whatsoever, and so on. And by the way, those are precisely the arguments that the British Crown and the Parliament of Great Britain and the British Ministry and newspapers used against us.
That you were being unpatriotic?
Of course. That citizens should be orderly. That the most important thing citizens should do is to obey existing laws, remain quiet, be orderly, and if there is something that we don't like, we should send polite missives or broadsides to those who are in charge of the world and ask them to take a look at such things. But I can tell you this, you can write a letter to the editor every day for the rest of your life and not get the attention of the people who matter. But if you take a musket into the street, I promise you they will pay attention.
So that may fly during your time, but not during mine.
Well, I'm not suggesting violence, but I'm saying it cannot be ruled out if you want to remain a free people. But what I am saying, certainly, is that anything that is nonviolent is an acceptable form of protest in a republic. And a republic that goes silent, where there is no protest, where there's no rebellion now and then, where there's no volatility in the populace, that is a dead society. Whenever you see a society that is absolutely orderly and there is no level of protest, there's no open discontentment, you know that that society is unhealthy and that it is being held together by despotism rather than by liberty.
I have to be careful here, sir, but what I think I'm hearing you saying is that protest is a high form of patriotism.
Well, let me remind you of how the American Revolution began. The citizens of Massachusetts, offended by acts of taxation in the Parliament and in the ministry that, for which they were not represented in Parliament, and objecting particularly to one of the lingering taxes on tea, those citizens in Boston Harbor disguised themselves as Native Americans, as Indians, and boarded British tea ships, commercial tea ships, in December of 1773, and threw a number of chests of tea into the harbor because they didn't want to pay the duties on that tea because they had not been represented in the Parliament that set those taxes. And that precipitated the crisis which led to the Declaration of Independence. So the British responded by closing the port and by stationing troops in Massachusetts. Now other states began to be alarmed. If this happened to Massachusetts Bay, why couldn't it happen to South Carolina or to Virginia or to New Hampshire? And so we created committees of correspondence to make sure we stayed abreast of the developments in Massachusetts. And that moment, that incendiary act of commercial terrorism, let's call it, so inspired the anxieties of the people of the 13 original colonies that it created a revolutionary movement that eventually swept British control off of the North American continent and enabled us to create our own republic. That probably would not have happened, our independence movement, had it not been for the Boston Tea Party. And the Boston Tea Party was not a petition. It was not an editorial. It was not a letter to the editor. It was not a remonstration to the British Parliament. It was an act of public theater which then forced the British to do one of two things, either to accommodate our just concerns or to ignore them at its peril. The king and the ministry and the Parliament, instead of redressing the grievances, now that they had been brought so forcibly to their attention, hardened their position and tried to stamp out these rebellious acts in Massachusetts, and in doing so, forced us into a state of national and open revolution.
Mr. President, another thing that is under attack in America these days, I suppose it's always been this way, you could verify that, are our newspapers, the press. You wrote to Dr. James Curry in 1786, sir, quote, "Our liberty depends on freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost." Nowadays, the press is called fake and wrong, and most assuredly, during your time and during mine, there are news reports that are written that are not completely honest, but it seems to me, sir, that you always defended the rights of the press.
Well, I didn't particularly like the press while I was serving as president. It attacked my personal life. It sometimes deliberately misconstrued public policy. It questioned my authority in a whole range of ways. It was annoying. Sometimes it was malicious. Often enough, it was simply in error, either because of laziness or one newspaper repeating the rumors that it found in another. You know, no one who really holds public office in the United States can ever have a wholly positive view of the press. Freedom is a dangerous thing. If there is freedom of the press, there will be irresponsible uses of that press, and there's not much you can do to sort it all out. And so I despaired of our free press from time to time, and I was mightily tempted at times to figure out some mechanism to restrain it. But the problem is, the minute you start to restrain the freedom of the press, you are entering a very dangerous zone, and it means that prickly, thin-skinned people, of which, by the way, I was one, will sometimes lash out at the press, not because it is irresponsible, but because it is damaging, because it is hurtful, because it is aggressive. And so we have to swallow hard and accept the freedom of the press, because the alternatives are all ones which erode liberty. But
Mr. President, what you're saying, if I hear you correctly, is that sometimes the press got it right and you were wrong.
And sometimes the press got it wrong and I was right. But if you believe in freedom of the press, you have to stay with it in good times and bad, when it's irresponsible and when it's spot on. But
you really feel that a free press is absolutely essential to the survival of America.
Well, so much so that in 1787, when I was very young, I said, given the choice between newspapers and no government, or government and no newspapers, I would not hesitate to prefer newspapers but no government. If the people are informed, they can govern themselves. But if the people are held in darkness because they can't get access to the information they need to make sense of the world, then they're ripe for despotism. They're ripe for tyranny.
But the press, they can't be allowed to just print anything and call it the truth.
The only thing that we can stop is malicious libel, deliberately designed to damage, and when it is false. So here's the criteria. It has to be deliberate misrepresentation and character assassination that's false and known by the reporter or the newspaper to be false. The truth is a defense. If someone says something malicious about me or James Madison, but it's true, that's acceptable under freedom of the press. The only thing that we can stop is character assassination maliciously intended using known false facts.
Mr. President, as always, I thank you so much for your insight. And let me say as well, sir, that I appreciate you taking the time to have a conversation about government. And perhaps the next time we speak, you could catch me up on your gardens and how things are at home.
Sir, if there were one man and one woman alive, free in every nation, it would be better than all of the despotisms of human history.
So we should look forward to protest as a healthy thing in America.
It is always a sign that the people have not utterly gone to sleep, that they continue to believe in their rights, and that when they feel that those rights are being trampled upon, they are not finally afraid to stand up, including the use of violence if necessary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jefferson.
You are welcome, sir.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson, and your weekly conversation with the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the man who portrays President Jefferson, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, David. You know, when I think about Jefferson and these statements, I like a little rebellion now and then, the tree of liberty, the blood of patriots and tyrants, and so on. It is very odd, and European intellectual by the name of Connor Cruz O'Brien wrote a book about this, in which he said, this is totally irresponsible. He said Jefferson didn't really mean this. He was a very timid sort of man. He never fired a gun in anger in his life. He said he just talks this way. He talks this way, who knows why, because he's a radical, because he wants rhetorical effect, because he likes the sound of his own voice. Who knows? But Connor Cruz O'Brien couldn't take Jefferson seriously, and he said, this is the wildest thing he said in his book about the subject. He said, if Jefferson was in earnest in saying those things, then he is the 18th century version of Pol Pot. And Pol Pot was the Cambodian tyrant who sent 2 million people to death camps.
That's a bit out, I think, don't you?
Yes.
But, I mean, I get his point, but, you know.
But it is true that, I mean, when you heard me today talking this way, defending rebellion, defending violence as a tool of human liberty.
But I take that with Jefferson's time in mind, because I think that violence in America today is certainly nothing representing what violence in America was during his time.
That's true. But when you hear this, your response, and mine too, is to say that was then and this is now. He couldn't mean that today.
I don't think he would say it the same way today. The question that I really had for him, and I would pose to you as well, is his long view, his feeling that the Shays' Rebellion was a test of our new government. You know, it led to good things. It led to the Constitutional Convention, but it was a test of this new nation's government. None of them knew whether we would survive or not. And Jefferson must have taken great pleasure in seeing that we could weather these protests and survive, and goodness would come out of it. Or am I being too optimistic?
No, I think that's exactly right. Jefferson liked to take the view from Jupiter or from the moon.
Right.
And when he looked down and he saw, for example, the French Revolution, including the Reign of Terror. So in the Reign of Terror, approximately 15,000 French aristocrats were beheaded by the mobs. Jefferson says, if you take a kind of lunar view of this, you realize the 10 or 15,000 people sacrificed to produce a better France is maybe an acceptable bloodletting. And he says, by the way, folks, when 10 or 15,000 people die in a war about most favored nation trading status or the mistresses of kings or silk scarves or a tiny piece of territory, we understand that as somehow the price of statecraft or the price of it's something inevitable in the world. He said, why do we find it acceptable to throw away 100,000 people in a war, but when the French people regain their long-lost liberties by way of decapitating the heads of a certain number of thousands of people, do we find that so appalling and abhorrent? Well, there are answers to that, of course, but Jefferson liked to take the long view, and his view was there probably has to be a cost of maintaining human liberty, and that cost is something we need to look at with some detachment. Otherwise, it'll be too visceral and too horrible for us to contemplate, and we'll shrink back from insisting upon a due respect for our rights.
There's such a rich trail of information from Jefferson's mind left in his letters. I'm going to give you a couple. One that he wrote to Edward Carrington in May of 1788 when he was in Paris. He said, "The natural progress of things is for liberty to yield and government to gain ground." And then in 1890, he wrote, "We are not expected to be translated from despotism to liberty in a feather bed."
Yeah. So they'll go to the first one.
Yeah, the
tendencies for liberty to yield and government to gain ground. I mean, nobody can doubt that, right?
Right, and you know, but that's an insight into who he was and how he thought.
And if you take the Tea Party and the alt-right and the conservative elements in Congress and even centrists, they're saying the tendency of things is for liberty to yield and government to gain ground through regulation, through executive order, through swollen bureaucracies, through unnecessary taxation, through waste and inefficiency. And they're right. Of course, we all know that our government, it needs cleansing, paring down, restoration. And Jefferson always loved, David, to use these organic metaphors. The view was, if you go out into your garden, you're going to cut away certain parts of your tomato plants so the rest can be healthy. You're going to prune trees so that the best part of the tree grows and it doesn't have seven trunks. That all gardeners understand that in order to produce fruit, you have to train the plant, and that involves some violence to this leaf or that stem or that false bud, that's just inevitable. That's good gardening, and no one could have a garden who doesn't understand this principle. We have to take the weeds out in order to let the fruit grow. And since Jefferson loves these organic metaphors, he says, you know, it's actually the same in social policy, that there has to be a certain amount of violent weeding in order for a body politic, a nation state, to be healthy and that we shouldn't necessarily be too afraid of this. Well, when I'm saying these words right now, it bothers me because it seems so cold and heartless and clinical and detached. But, you know, I think we all know that Jefferson meant this and he didn't mean it at the same time. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, and into that second quote, we are not expected to be translated from despotism to liberty in a feather bed. Again, it's a bit of hyperbole.
But how do we get there from here? So, you know, look at things today. So you have this gazillion-dollar national debt. We have these mandates, these entitlements that are on the road to insolvency. Bureaucratic rules, you know, the Trump administration has said the two bureaucratic regulations have to be eliminated for every new one. They won't be able to make that stand.
Well, they, you know, he's not filling a lot of positions. He's doing what Jefferson did.
There is a Jeffersonian element to what Trump is doing. And let me say what I think that means. One is an honest understanding that things are out of control. Number two, a realization that, of course, things will be out of control if you leave them alone, and that you can't reform them. You have to shake them. You have to shake the system.
Let's please be careful if we're comparing our current president to President Jefferson.
I'm just telling you the areas where there is an agreement about established bureaucracies and big government and taxation.
Except that I think Jefferson had a plan, and he followed through on it.
Jefferson understood that politeness. That, you know, just the critique that's now being made by the alt-right, that as long as you let Congress be Congress, there will be no solution to these problems because they've already proved that they don't have the moral courage to make the hard choices that the American people need.
I just have a lot of trouble when there's a lack of civility. And,
of course.
I remember those no drama days, and I agree too much drama.
The Trump administration is not civil. And that Jefferson was an infinitely more subtle thinker.
But it's what the public wanted.
But my point is that both the Trump administration and Jefferson understand that you have to shake the system to fix the system, that there is no comfortable, organic, internal reform, that it needs to be shaken.
So you're saying the current administration would say that the Tree of Liberty needs to be watered with?
The current administration uses another organic metaphor. It says that the swamp needs to be drained. You know, their view is that the establishment culture of America, that's the news media, the great nonprofit foundations, the elitist intellectual universities, the permanent bureaucracy, that whole world and Congress is a swamp, and that they have created a fetid, unhealthy miasma from which there can be no national health, and they say there will be bankruptcy, and the only way to fix it is not to put in a little water purification tablet from time to time. You have to drain that swamp and start over. I don't necessarily agree with what they're saying or doing, David, but I see the roots and their distinguished roots in American history.
I want to close with one more Jefferson quote. It's fun to watch his mind and his approach change, and this was written in 1813 to Adams during that famous period of the Adams-Jefferson letters. Jefferson wrote, "Everyone by his property or by his satisfactory situation is interested in the support of law and order, and such men may safely and advantageously reserve to themselves a wholesome control over their public affairs and a degree of freedom which, in the hands of the common people of the cities of Europe, would be instantly perverted to the demolition and destruction of everything public and private."
Right. He wanted an orderly system where we would debate these policy questions and there would be a high level of mutual respect, a search for compromise.
So he moved from the Tree of Liberty to that.
Well, Jefferson was able to contain both of these things in his brain at the same time, but his instincts were for harmony. His intellect was for chaos.
Great conversation this week, Mr. Jenkinson.
I always enjoy
Mr.
these,
Jefferson.
My friend.
I do too. And I hate to call it to a close, but it is now time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
Thank you, sir. I know people who feel strongly that professional football players should stand during the national anthem. They feel that the anthem is a symbol of American unity, a tribute to our servicemen and women, and that it is not patriotic to sit or kneel during the Star-Spangled Banner. I respect people who feel this way, but I also disagree with them, and here's why. What I know about protest I have learned by reading the work of Thomas Jefferson. If you've been listening to the Jefferson Hour for any length of time, you know that Jefferson was a revolutionary. In his carefully crafted letters, he told Abigail Adams and James Madison that he liked a little rebellion now and then. In a letter to William Smith, Jefferson wrote, "God forbid we should ever be more than 20 years without a rebellion." He said, "What country can preserve its liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? Let them take arms." The NFL players in question are not shooting the referees for reaching for their penalty flags. They're not tearing down the goalposts at halftime. They're not beating up random fans in the stands. They're not blowing up the football on the 45-yard line. And they're not ripping through the giant American flag that is stretched across the field or throwing bleach or blood onto it. They are quietly kneeling without shouting slogans or obscenities. This does not sound very incendiary to me or very radical. Jefferson defended the French Revolution, including the Reign of Terror, as a necessary bloodletting to restore the equilibrium and justice to life in France. To be patriotic is to love this country. To love this country is to want it to live up to its ideals. To want it to live up to its ideals is to be willing to criticize it when it fails to do so. If you think this country never fails to live up to its ideals, you have not paid the slightest attention to the wild ride of American history. If you think we never fail to live up to the promise of America, you are not Black, Hispanic, poor, or Native American, and you have not bothered to project your imagination beyond your own comfort. When I watch the video of athletes kneeling in silence, I see purpose, dignity, anguish, and conviction. The NFL athletes have certainly gotten our attention. All of America is now talking about the protests. That includes people who would rather talk about anything else. In their quiet, nonviolent, and dignified way, these athletes have forced all of us to talk not only about what kinds of protests are legitimate in a sprawling continental democracy like ours, whether corporation owners have a right to censor the free expression of their employees, and whether politicians can legitimately try to coerce corporation owners to censor their employees. But we are also talking about the real issue: police brutality, race profiling, whether the seemingly routine shooting of Black suspects is justified, whether there is structural and institutional racism at the center of American life, or, to put it in a slogan, whether Black lives matter in American life as much as white lives matter. I wish we were talking about this issue more and the sanctity of the national anthem less, but that still may come. Protest is a central virtue in the American experiment. Its roots are in the Boston Tea Party on December 16, 1773, and Daniel Shea's Rebellion of 1786, the event that triggered the Constitutional Convention, or the various slave rebellions that were a prelude to John Brown's terrorist raid on the U.S. arsenal at Harper's Ferry on October 16, 1859. Think of the silent protest of the Underground Railroad, in which an estimated 100,000 Black slaves were shepherded out of the plantation south to free northern states or to Canada as a response to the inhuman violations of human right that was slavery. Think of the labor movement of the post-Civil War period, or the protests of women demanding that they be given the vote in the United States and then equal access to employment and then control of their reproductive destiny. Think of Rosa Parks silently refusing to move to the back of the bus. Do you remember the white outrage then by people who felt that this was not the time or place to raise the issue of equal access to taxpayer-supported public transport? Think of the vast national protest against the Vietnam War, the worldwide anti-nuclear movement of the 1970s and 1980s. In each of these moments, some of them among the great moments in American history, the reactionaries have said, "Not now, not here, not about this, not patriotic, not legitimate, not American." But Jefferson understood this better than all of the rest of us combined, and he understood it back at the very beginning of our national experiment. He understood that petitions and letters to the editor do not redress the wrongs of a civilization. He understood that you have to be able to get the attention of the community, and to do so, you have to be willing to violate the norms of civil complacency. "I like a little rebellion now and then," said Jefferson. The athletes who are kneeling at NFL games are not attempting to tear down American civilization. They are not moving us toward anarchy and social collapse. No, they are quietly asking the rest of us to attend to a central problem of American life, that to be born black in America means that your life is going to be more vulnerable, more marginal, and more dangerous, that if you are born black, you are born into second-class citizenship status, and the great institutions of the country, including the police and the judicial system, appear to line up against you more often than not. That is the question that all people who prize equality should want to address earnestly, not reluctantly, and now, indeed, is the time. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.